The Good GP podcast is excited to have MedTech Global as a sponsor. MedTech is on a mission to digitally transform general practice so GPs can focus on quality patient care. For more information about MedTech Global, visit medtechglobal.com.
You're listening to The Good GP, the podcast for busy GPs.
Hello and welcome to The Good GP. I'm Rebecca Goatby, and before we start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on where this podcast is recorded. Alison, Sean and I are on Whadjuk country in the Noongar Nation, and we pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. I'd also like to mention the opportunity for a listener takeover. If you have an idea for a podcast or would like to record an episode, please get in touch with us at thegoodgp@gmail.com. Today, Sean and I are interviewing Dr. Alison Craig, who is known to our listeners from the episodes on intimate partner violence and progesterone overdose. Today, Alison is talking to us on how to manage the side effects of long-acting reversible contraceptives, otherwise known as LARCs. Welcome, Alison.
Thanks, Rebecca.
So the first question we're going to tackle is, one of the commonest issues with the contraceptive implant seems to be unpredictable bleeding. What are some things we can do about that?
Yeah, there are quite a few, luckily. I guess the first one is just to have a little think about the pattern of bleeding and is there any chance it's not the contraceptive implant? So thinking about infection, particularly in younger people, and also the cancers and the polyps and those sorts of things. If it is a very young person at low risk of a cancer, then it might be reasonable just to do an STI swab and then proceed to manage it. If it's an older person, I would just maybe do a little bit more investigating, unless it seems to be extremely clearly related to the implant, so it's the first month or two. All right, but once we're happy that there's nothing abnormal going on, then it's useful to talk to the patient about the different options. If it's fairly early on in the life of the implant, one of the options is just to reassure the person, look, we've checked for anything going wrong and it's pretty normal for the contraceptive implant in the first few months. Do you want to just wait and see what happens? Sometimes it settles and sometimes it doesn't. Then another option is to try treating it. And really the best, the most effective of those options is the combined pill. As long as there are no contraindications to using the combined pill, we usually suggest continuous use for 2 or 3 months, stop, have a withdrawal bleed, and then see what happens. For many people, it just gives them that little bit of extra time, bit of a break from the bleeding, and the bleeding is not so troublesome after that. There are a few people where they just get frequent bleeding back again, and they're struggling with that. They're not too keen on relying on the combined pill for the ongoing contraception because they're not that great at taking it, but just choose to take it to manage bleeding while they're using the really effective contraceptive implant for their contraception. If that's not acceptable or unsuitable, there are a few other options, but they're not as effective. And I do find that doesn't help as much with the bleeding. But it's worth considering anti-inflammatories taken regularly for 5 days, using tranexamic acid, particularly if it's heavier bleeding, which is not terribly common, but again, regularly for 5 days. Or slightly lower level of evidence, but the progesterone-only pill, just taken regularly for a couple of months, can also be tried. I've only tried that a few times with patients. It's had some impact, but maybe not managed it quite well enough. The other strategies is just to really rethink the contraception options, see if it is something else that might be of use that they could switch to. We always recommend that you organise something else well before the contraceptive implant comes out, because as soon as the implant comes out, the fertility is straight back. So we know in the studies, people ovulate the next day.
Yeah, right.
And certainly a lot of people ovulate pretty quickly after it comes out. So ideally, you'll start something else and have it working before the implant comes out. And then there's one more strategy, and that's if the bleeding, and we do get a few patients with this happening, if the bleeding seems to become problematic in the last year of use. So they've had it in for 2.5 years. And then they seem to just be getting more and more frequent bleeding. We've had a think about the abnormal causes. We haven't found anything there. Just replacing it a bit early is sometimes of value. Unfortunately, we can't guarantee that, but it's worth the try if the person is otherwise happy with the implant.
Good stuff. So, Alison, how common are things like weight gain, headaches, and loss of libido with the contraceptive implants?
I wish I knew. They're all in the product information for the contraceptive implant. They're listed really as up to sort of 10 or 12%, you know, things like headaches and breast tenderness are listed as quite common. But the question is, are they actually caused by the implant? Because a lot of headaches and breast tenderness occur when you're not using a contraceptive implant. So we know there are lots of other potential causes for those potential side effects. Trying to work out, well, is it a side effect of the contraception or not? A couple of clues that can be helpful are just understanding the timing. So when did that potential side effect begin? If it's 18 months after the contraception has begun, that's pretty unlikely to be related to the contraception. That's very likely caused by other factors in life. But if it seems to be really within the first week, the first month, then there's a good chance that it is related to the implant. Another clue that might help you is understanding if people have had problems with hormonal changes in the past. So have they had premenstrual symptoms? Have they had significant postpartum issues? Have they reacted badly to other methods of contraception that contain similar hormones? So they're all clues that help to work out, is it actually a side effect? Yeah. So I'm sorry that was a vague answer. I can't tell you it's 10%. But how many people come in and have it removed because of those side effects? Actually, it's nowhere near 10%.
Yeah.
Certainly the commonest reason people have things like the contraceptive implant removed is the bleeding issue.
Yep.
A few people in my experience have had it removed because of mood issues or skin problems. One person had it removed because they got hot flushes, which is, I don't think that's on the line, this list of side effects, but she was a pretty dainty little person. And I just presume she got a bit more ovarian suppression and reduced estrogen in the early days of her contraceptive implant. And it certainly resolved when we took out the implant. So that was a bit of a rare one, I think.
Thank you for that. That was, yeah, really informative and interesting. We're going to move on to talk about IUDs now. What are the main problems for people using an IUD for contraception, and what are some strategies that we can use to correct those?
Yeah, so the main things, I think, are the insertion process, what happens with bleeding afterwards, and to some extent, for a few people, the cramping that can occur after the procedure. So with the insertion process, really, the main thing that people are really worried about is pain. And the main deal for most people during the insertion is either pain or fear of pain. Just some suggestions. Make sure you have a really careful discussion with the patient before the insertion about how that can be managed. We do suggest taking anti-inflammatories beforehand, having the option of the local anaesthetic spray. In fact, most of us routinely use local anaesthetic spray to the cervix and waiting the full 3 minutes for that to work. But also keeping calm and seeing if we can keep the patient calm, even entertained during the procedure, and certainly distracted from the main stuff that's going on. We can also offer methoxyfluorine inhaler, the green whistle, if people are really struggling. I think another couple of tips are offering having a support person. They're often a bit more stressed than the person having the IUD though. So sometimes it's not the greatest suggestion. Looking at partners who see the equipment we're using and seeing their faces, sometimes they get a bit put off. Just making sure the patient knows they're the one in charge, so they can cause it all to stop if it's just getting too much or if they need a pause. So really sort of handing over the control to the patient. If it's too horrible, we're just going to stop. Then we'll work out what we're going to do from there. One option that's helpful to offer to people, particularly if they're really worried about it beforehand, or if they're really struggling during the process, is you can have it done under sedation. So not a lot of clinics can offer that, but certainly in Perth, the clinics that offer abortions also do IUD insertion under sedation. And that's our most common referral pathway if people would just prefer to be asleep during the procedure. Just with the other issues about bleeding. So again, preparing the patient beforehand, knowing what is likely to happen and also what can happen is helpful. So with the hormonal IUDs, pretty likely you'll get quite frequent bleeding for the first few months. For many people, that's really settled down by the 3-month mark. But for a few people, it can last really up to 6 months. And it's normal, and we don't usually do anything about it, except if it's troubling you, you can come in and we'll have a chat about some management options. So with the copper IUDs, it's important that people understand that they might get heavier bleeding or more painful periods after the copper insertion goes in. There are some management strategies we can try if they're struggling with that. And quite often it's a little bit worse for a few months and then it settles, but we can't guarantee that it's going to settle. But we can give the usual anti-inflammatories or tranexamic acid just to try and manage those symptoms if that's needed. And then the final main problem is that a very few people get lots of cramping for the first month after the IUD insertion. And we presume that the uterus is really just trying to expel the IUD quite firmly. We know in time it's going to settle down, but sometimes giving some anti-inflammatories or other analgesics just to help to get people through. It might be a day, it might be a few days, might be a week.
Okay, thank you. Alison, many women have concerns around their fertility with the use of long-acting contraceptives. What advice do you give them about the impact on fertility and return of normal menses on ceasing a LARC?
Lovely question. Thanks, Sean. Fortunately, the answer is very simple. There's only one contraceptive method that has any ongoing impact on fertility these days, and that's the depot injection. So that's got the potential for it to take 3, 6, or 12 months for fertility to return. Everything else, so the IUDs and the contraceptive implant and the pills and the vaginal ring, fertility really returns within that first month after stopping.
Yeah.
So it comes straight to that person's normal fertility for that age.
Great. That's good to know and nice to be able to reassure our patients. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think there are a few myths that are around from when we use different, maybe higher pill doses, for example, but also some of the older IUDs, that there was a much higher risk of damage to the uterus and pelvic infection. So I think some of those old contraceptive methods have caused these myths about fertility to persist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Alison. That's been so informative. We really appreciate your time today. And yeah, we look forward to hearing again soon.
Good. Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Good GP podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. Make sure you're subscribed on your favourite podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions or would like to contact The Good GP, send an email to thegoodgp@gmail.com. The content of this podcast represents the opinions of The Good GP, hosts and guests of the show. The content is aimed at general practitioners working in the Australian context and is not intended to represent medical advice. Any listeners experiencing symptoms or who have concerns about their health should seek advice from a registered health professional. We make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate and up to date at the time of recording, but welcome any feedback or corrections. The content of this podcast is general in nature and does not refer to specific patient management. We recommend all health professionals review local and up-to-date guidelines prior to any clinical decisions.